"I find it very dutiful," said Petitpré, "that you are willing to do this, too, after all you have done for me. Do you not think that thus justice would in more than one respect be re-established in the world, in that you, by this change, would be advanced in proportion as he is diminished, and put in a position of advantage which must afford you a compensation for his advancement, highly satisfying, considering your peculiar build?" "There is something in that," Dudu replied. "I will not deny that it might be a consideration, though secondary." And he folded his arms, thrust one shoulder forward, and began to sway to and fro with his front leg going up and down. He seesawed there, nodding his head and looking pertly about as his spirits rose higher and higher. "But again," went on Petitpré, "he could hardly remain at the head of the house after you had revenged yourself thus upon him." "No, of course not," laughed Dudu, continuing to posture. "To be at the head of the house and give orders to the household is no office for a chastened criminal. It is the service of a capable and unmutilated man, competent to represent the master in every affair which he cannot and will not take upon himself." "Then," concluded the captain, "I should know at once the suitable reward for your great service, that I may thank and pay you for your service as spy, and for striving to save me from shame and death." "I should hope," cried Dudu, abandoned to arrogance, "I may hope that you will understand my merits and be clear as to their reward and the succession, for it is not too much to say that I have saved you from shame and death, and our lovely sinner as well. She should know that I begged for mercy for her on the ground of her loneliness in bed, giving her her life, so that she has breath only through my favor. For if I choose, and she prove ungrateful, I can publish abroad her shame in city and land, and you would be forced to strangle her after all, and lay her delicate body in ashes, or at least to send her back to her family, minus her nose and ears. Let her be advised, poor light of love. Let her turn her jeweled eyes away from unfruitful beauty to bend them upon Dudu, who knows how to console. Master of the mistress, stout little steward over all the house." And he cast ever blither glances on this side and that into space, wreathed and writhed with shoulders and hips, pranced on his little feet, and in short, behaved just like a cock at courting time, blind and deaf to his peril, utterly absorbed in his performance. And it befell him, too, as it befalls the cock, for with one bound, Petitpré, the master, was out from under the sheet, quite naked, a tower of flesh with a little head atop. Another bound took him to the chair where his clothes lay, and he swung his cudgel. We have seen this ornamental emblem of office in his hand, or one like it, the thick stick covered with gilded leather, with a pine cone on top, and a gilt wreath round it. It was probably a symbol of power, also probably a fetish and cult object in female ritual. The master swung it suddenly, and let it fall on Dudu's shoulders and back. He beat him until the dwarf was deaf and blind, though on quite other grounds than before, and squealed like a stuck pig. "Oh, oh, ow, ow!" he yelled, and writhed at his hips. "Oh, it hurts! It is killing me! My bones are broken! I bleed! Mercy! Mercy! Have pity on your faithful servant!" But Petitpré had none. "There! That's for you, you shameless spy! You sneak! You snake in the grass! Who have confessed to me all your treachery!" And drove him under a rain of blows round and round the bedroom, until the faithful servant found the door, took to his legs, and ran. The Threat. And it came to pass, the story tells us, that Potiphar's wife spake to Joseph day by day, and entreated him that he should lie with her. So he gave her occasion, then? Even after the episode of the injured tongue, he did not avoid her presence, but still came together with her in various places and at various times? He did. He probably had to, for she was the mistress, a female master, and could command his presence when she liked. But also he had promised not to forsake her in her distress, but to console her with words as he alone could, because he owed her that much. He saw this. He was bound to her by the consciousness of his guilt. Admitting in his heart that he had lightheadedly let things come to this pass, and that his pedagogic plan of salvation had been a very culpable pretense, whose consequences he must now endure, and as far as possible, amend, however dangerous, difficult, and unlikely any amendment seemed. Shall we then count it to his credit that he did not withdraw his countenance from the smitten one, but day by day, or shall we say, nearly every day, exposed himself to the breath of the fiery bull, that he still dared and went on daring to face one of the strongest temptations which have probably ever assailed any youth in the history of the world? Yes, probably, conditionally and in part. Some of his motives were excellent, we may grant him that. His sense of guilt and obligation was praiseworthy. So was his stout-hearted reliance on God and his seven reasons in the hour of need. Perhaps we may respect even the defiance which had begun to guide his conduct, and which demanded of him that he measure the strength of his reason against the madness of this woman. For she had threatened him. She had sworn to tear off the garland he wore for the sake of his God, and crown him with her own. He found that shameless. And I must say here that another element came in, which in time made him think of the matter as something between his God and the gods of Egypt. Just as to her also her zeal for Amun gradually became, or was made by others, a ground for her desire. We may understand, we may even approve, his feeling that it was not permitted him to shirk, that he must see the matter through to the bitter end, and make it redound to the honor of his God. All very well, yet not quite wholly so, for there was an admixture of another motive for his obeying her, going to her and meeting her, and this, he very well knew, was not quite so creditable. Shall I call it curiosity? Irresponsibility? The unwillingness to give up the free choice of the bad course? The desire to preserve his freedom for a while yet, though without any intention of deciding on the wrong side? However serious, even dangerous, the situation, did he take pleasure in being alone with the mistress on a certain footing, in calling her my child, and feeling justified on the ground of her passion and despair? A commonplace assumption, yet justifiable, along with another, more godly or more profound, that product of his fantasy, the highly alluring, deeply thrilling thought, that is, of his death and deification as Osarsif, and the state of sacred readiness that belonged with it, above which, nonetheless, there hung the ass's curse. Enough, then, he went to the mistress. He stuck by her. He suffered her to speak to him day by day, and to entreat him, lie with me. He suffered it, I say, for it was no joke and no small matter to persevere with this woman possessed by desire, to speak kindly to her, and yet on his own side to sustain the seven reasons in full force and fend off her demands, despite the sympathy which in some measure flowed toward them from his own dead and deified state. Truly one is inclined to overlook the less praiseworthy among the motives of the son of Jacob, when one considers the trouble he must have had with the unhappy woman, for she daily so besieged him that he had moments when he understood Gilgamesh, who in furious impatience one day tore out the phallus of the sacred bull and flung it in Ishtar's face. For she degenerated daily, and grew less and less delicate in the importunities with which she besought him that they might put their heads and feet together. She never at least came back to that idea of hers to murder the master, and do away with him that they might reign as mistress and lord of love in soft garments amid flowers and lead a life of bliss. She saw that the idea was entirely repugnant to him, and must have feared to estrange him by repeating it. Her drunken and clouded state did not prevent her from seeing the perfect justice of his decided refusal even to consider the wild project, and that he did not need to conceal his indignant rejection of a proposal which even she would find it hard to bring up again with a whole tongue and without the excuse of a childish lisp. But she did not abandon the plea that there was no sense in refusing her, since they already shared the secret, and might just as well, so to speak, get the good of it. She went back to it again and again, holding out the promise of unspeakable bliss, which he would find in her loving arms, in her body, which had stored all its treasures up for him. And when to that sweet wooing he only answered, "My child, we may not," she proceeded to try to spur him on with doubts about his masculinity. Not that she took these seriously herself, it is hardly possible, but on the face of it, she was somewhat justified by his response to her mockery. Joseph could not come out with his 7 reasons. Most of them she could not even have understood, and what he offered instead was certainly feeble, stupid, and badly invented. What, for instance, could she, in her passion and extremity, make of the moral thesis which he would once and for all have made his answer, that it might be on the lips of the peoples in case this story of theirs became history, namely, that his master had put all that he had into his hands, save only herself, because she was his wife, and how then could he do this great wickedness and sin with her? That was threadbare rubbish. It could not serve her need and passion. And even if she had found herself in a history, Mut'em Enit was convinced that everybody and at all times would find it justifiable that such a pair as she and Joseph were should put their heads and feet together, regardless of the captain of the guard and her titular husband. She was sure that anybody would take much more pleasure in it than in a moral thesis. What else did he say? Something like this. "You want me to come by night and sleep with you? But it has been just by night that our God, whom you do not know, has mostly revealed himself to men. If, then, he would reveal himself to me in the night, and found me thus, what would become of me?" That was childish. Or he would say, "I fear because of Adam, who was driven out of the garden on account of so small a sin. How then would I be punished?" She found that as pitiable as the one which followed. "You cannot know all these things, but my brother Reuben lost his firstborn right because he was unstable, and the father gave it to me. He would take it away again if he knew that you had made an ass of me." That must have seemed to her the sheerest pusillanimity. He could not be surprised, when he had dragged in some such lame excuses by the hair, that she answered them, weeping tears of rage the while, by saying that there was nothing left but for her to believe that the garland which he wore was nothing else than the straw wreath of impotence. She could hardly have meant what she said. Rather, it was a desperate challenge to the honor of his flesh, and the look with which he answered her shamed and inflamed her equally, for it spoke with more eloquence and emotion even than his words. "Do you think so?" he said bitterly. "Then be quiet. For if it were with me as you pretend to think, then were it easy, and my temptation were not like a dragon and a roaring lion. Believe me, woman, I have had the thought of putting an end to your agony and mine by making of myself what you impute to me, like the youth in one of your legends, who took a sharp leaf of the sword plant, and cut himself, and threw the offending member into the river for fish to devour, to witness his innocence. But I may not. The sin were as great as though I yielded, and I should be no use to God any more, for he wills that I remain whole and sound." "Horrible!" she cried. "O Sarsif, whither did your thoughts tend? Do it not, my beloved, my glorious one. It would be such a dreadful pity. Never could I mean what I said. You love me. You love me. Your angry look betrays your love, and your blasphemous purpose. Sweet one, oh, come and save me. Staunch my streaming blood, for pity of its flowing." But he answered, "It may not be." Then she grew wrathful, and began to threaten him with martyrdom and death. So far had she come. It was this that haunted me when I said that she grew less and less fastidious in her choice of means. He learned now with whom he had to do, and what she had meant by her ringing cry, "Frightful am I alone in my love." The giant cat lifted her paw. Threateningly she put out her claws from their velvet sheath to tear his flesh. If he would not do her will, not yield her his sacred wreath, to receive in exchange the garland of bliss, then she must and would destroy him. Urgently she implored him to take her words seriously and not as empty sound, for he could see that she was ready for any and everything. She would accuse him to Petipre of that which he denied her, and tax him with assault upon her virtue. She would say that he had done violence to her, and the accusation would be a joy, and she would know how to act the ruined and maculate, so that no one would doubt what she said. Her word and oath, he might be sure, would count before his in this house, and no denial would help him. Besides, she was convinced that he would not deny, but in silence take the guilt upon himself, for that it had come to this despair and fury with her was his fault, the fault of his eyes, his mouth, his golden shoulders, and his denial of her love. He would see that it was all one in what accusations one clothed his guilt, for every accusation became true by virtue of the truth of his guilt, and he must be prepared to suffer death. But it would be a death which would make him rue his silence, and even perhaps his cruel denial of her love. For men like Petipre were inventive in revenge, and for the libertine who debauched the mistress, there would be found a kind of death that left nothing to be desired in the way of refined torture. And now she told him how he would die, painting it to him, sometimes in her singing, ringing tones, again in whispers close to his ear, like the tender murmurings of love. "Hope not," she whispered, "that it will be quick, casting you from a rock, or hanging you head down till the blood soon rushes to your brain and death comes gently. So merciful it will not be. After the beatings that will mangle your back when Petipre pronounces sentence, for when I disclose your violent deed, he will be seized with a sandstorm such as comes from the mountains of the east, and his fury will rage, and his malice be unbounded. It is horrible to be given to the crocodile, to lie bound and helpless in the reeds when the devourer draws nigh, and his wet belly glides over you, beginning his meal with shoulder or thigh, so that your wild shrieks mingle with his satisfied gruntings as he feeds, for nobody will hear or heed. For I have heard when it happened to others, and felt a light pity, without much thought or realization, one's own flesh being safe. But now it is yourself and your flesh which the oncoming devourer nuzzles, beginning in this place or that, while you are fully conscious, and would hold back the inhuman shriek that wrings itself from your breast. Shriek not, beloved, for me, who would have kissed you where that wet belly sets his teeth.